Thank you, Sergey. So it's fun. I was one of the organizers of the previous workshop, and I've got to fess up that, you know, what I spend most of my days and nights doing is developing density functional theory, which may or may not be the most popular theory here. I doubt it. So what I'm going to talk about is a sort of little idea that, so when we had the workshop in the fall, especially the people who were into strongly correlated systems were very interested in this idea. And it's not really my idea. It's the idea of an old friend of Gabby Kotlier's and mine's, Morrill Cohen, who has been hanging out in New Jersey since he retired from Exxon. It was really his idea. It came out of thinking about a lot of stuff over about a period of 10 years, basically chemical reactivity theory. And then he did this work initially with a student of mine, Adam Wasserman, who went on, who's now got a faculty position at Purdue in chemistry. But the most recent stuff that I'll show you has been done by Peter Elliott, who was a student of mine in physics, and he's now a postdoc with Nipa Mitra at Hunter College. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is not, I'm not going to give you a new, there will be no calculations on any real systems. There won't even be any approximations, you know, methods for doing calculations. It's just one idea, that's all, just one little idea, but it's a kind of subtle idea. And I can say it's not mine, it's really Morrill Cohen's. Okay. So, and it's really a sort of formalism which gives you a way of making explicit connections between what I'll roughly call band theory and the atomistic limit. So a way of setting up your way of thinking, your formal machinery or whatever, where you can unite these two. And we've only done model calculations so far as sort of proof of principle, but that should change in the next year or so. And what I hope to convince you is that there are many opportunities for making connections between these sort of what I'll call these two camps. One is strongly correlated systems. The other is people doing DFT type electronic structure calculations. And I'll apologize in advance, it's written in DFT language, but that's not because it has to be, it's because it's the only one I'm really familiar with these days. And part of the deal in giving the talk today is to try to get some help in writing it in other languages. You'll see why in a minute. Okay, so the outline of the talk is I'll give you a very quick view of DFT, highlighting the parts that are going to be relevant. Partition theory, then I'll talk about these fragment calculations and then most importantly the implications. So, and you know, an important thing, now I got to apologize because there's a few people here who've heard some of my jokes before, and so I apologize in advance, right? But anyway, so 1965, Cohen and Cham wrote down these formally exact equations, right? A little footnote at the end of the paper that they're formally exact, in which you just do this sort of translation of a many-body problem into an effective non-interacting problem. But the idea is that if you knew the exact missing piece of the exchange correlation energy as a function of the density, you could get the exact ground state energy and density even for an interacting system. And to sort of emphasize that, I always like to show this picture. This is the density of the helium atom. And this is in atomic units, the one body potential minus 2/r. And this dashed line here is the exact Cohn-Cham potential for the helium atom. If I put two non-interacting electrons into the ground state, W occupy the 1s orbital of this potential, I get exactly that density. And pretty much all modern DFT calculations are approximating this guy, getting accurate densities, hopefully accurate densities, and feeding it back in and getting the ground state energy.
So the exact one was reconstructed from exact guess.
Exactly, right. It's a one-line thing to reconstruct it. And people have many algorithms for doing that these days.
And the plane line was within which approximation?
This line is minus 2 over R. It's the one-body potential, right?
So how about LDA? Would it be pretty close to the...
No, LDA is pretty crummy. Potentials don't look particularly good because the whole structure of DFT has been designed to give you ground state energies, right? And you tend to get fairly good-looking densities, but the potentials don't look good. If you can ever go back and look inside, if you're running any kind of DFT calculation, you'll see that. But that's a whole other issue, slightly related to what we'll talk about. Now, problems with standard DFT, band gaps are bad. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Symmetry dilemma, this is the most important thing. When you stretch, so we'll focus on this the whole time pretty much. Take a hydrogen molecule and you stretch it, all sorts of things go wrong in your standard DFT calculation. Depends where you grew up, what you call them. Basically, the atomic limit is given by the Heitler-London wave function. No theory like the Cohn-Sham theory. We don't have any approximations that can really dissociate hydrogen correctly into isolated hydrogen atoms. There's a self-interaction error. A lot of people talk about that. People talk about SIC, LDA-SIC, so there's self-interaction corrected, and also called a delocalization error because it causes the electrons to delocalize. And nowadays we have far too many functionals, right? And I have this other big thing going on, semi-classical stuff, which some of us might get together to discuss this afternoon because I got to go back to Irvine tonight. It sort of examines why any of these approximations work at all. Let's not worry about that. Okay, so too many functionals. This always gets a laugh. This is my student made up. These are all the functional. This is a subsection of the functionals that are coded up in standard codes that are around today. It's a mess, right? So it's become very empirical. And this I'm just sort of putting up, this is not really germane to the talk. Things users despise about DFT, right? I think, have you seen an early version of this? There's no simple rule for reliability. There's no systematic route to improvement, right? Raise your hand if you disagree with any of this, right? If your property turns out to be inaccurate, you must wait several decades for a solution, right? Such as DMFT must be developed, right? Back in the old days, there was no DMFT, right? Too bad. Plutonium is 30%, what is it, smaller than it ought to be. Complete disconnect from other methods, right? Just the language is all different, it's all funny and it ain't the same. Full of arcane insider jargon, self-interaction correction symmetry dynamic, and too many functionals to choose from. Now my next slide, you can only learn about DFT from another DFT guru, right? That's an important part because, right? So that's what people don't like about DFT, right? Now here's a list of things that developers love about DFT, right? Look, it looks a little bit like the one I just showed you, right? You must have gotten them mixed up somewhere, right? Okay, so what we're going to talk about is how to try to cross this divide and why there is such a divide, right? So I want to make this distinction. I'm not going to talk about calculations of specific systems, right? Note that this question is more common with quantum chemists, say. This question might be more common with solid-state physicists. I'm not going to talk about approximations, right? We have to make these distinctions quite clearly. Within DFT, there's this formally exact idea, and then there are approximations that you see in practice. And we are going to talk about formalisms, and you see I listed some. I couldn't get the little umlaut to come up on the Schrodinger. Greens, functions, path integrals. These are all very standard ways of treating many-body quantum problems, and here's DFT off in left field, or in this case, right field, right? And, with a little, I should draw a little circle around it, right, because it's adherents kind of like to sort of close themselves off and have this little world of their own, right? Oh gosh, I just remembered that this is being recorded. Ah, okay. Now, here's something important, right? So I do DFT, I developed DFT, it's okay for me to make jokes about DFT, right? Suppose I give you the exact exchange correlation function, all right, which I actually often do. I have it in my pocket. I bring it out at conferences. This is the ground state exchange correlation. You don't get various things. Excitations, response properties in general, right? You typically don't get now. So there's confusion because the DFT types like to say, well, everything in principle is a functional of the density. And that's true. But the thing that we've studied for decades and decades is this exchange correlation energy functional. And when you have that, you get certain properties, but not all of them, right? The fact that the others are in principle functionals of the density doesn't actually mean squat. A Cohn-Sham band gap equal to the correct one, right? So if you have the exact exchange correlation functional, your Cohn-Sham gap is not equal to the true gap of the system. It's not supposed to be, and it isn't. What you can get is lots of, you know, important information, right? And you can apply, if you had this exchange correlation functional, you could apply it to all sorts of strongly correlated systems. And you would get these ground state properties correctly by definition. But you wouldn't get lots of the things that you care about. And in particular, I guess the biggest thing is you don't get the spectral function, right? You don't get that period. It's not supposed to give you that. You could get the true gap, the fundamental gap, which people don't sort of often realize, because you could do a calculation without your periodic boundary conditions, take a big clump of the object, and add, take away an electron and add an electron and look at the energy differences, and that would tell you the true gap of the system. So you can get the real gap, but not by staring at the Cohn-Sham band structure. Okay, so what we're going to be talking about are sort of exact things, right? And this was from a friend of mine, Wai Tao Yang, in Science, well, now a couple of years ago, talking about the sort of prototype problems in DFT type calculations. And one is the H2 plus binding curve. So it's a one electron problem, but DFT has the self-interaction error. You pull it apart, and the self-interaction error goes bananas. And here's the Hartree-Fock, which of course is perfect. It's just one electron, and here's two standard functionals. Here's your LDA going really bad. And then the H2 binding curve, as I mentioned, pulls it apart. And all Hartree-Fock and B3UF and LDA all get it wrong by an awful lot because they have restricted wave functions. They always model they use a doubly occupied molecular orbital to describe the wave function, and you get the energetics very bad. Don't worry about this so much. Okay. So DFT is always in real space and produces sort of basis set.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Yeah, please, please.
To the previous slide.
Yeah.
How can anything get a non-zero binding energy, even if it's positive, at a very large separation? What does that even mean? Infinitely far apart.
Yeah. So
it has the wrong energy for a single atom with one electron on it?
No. Okay. So let me go through this. So let's just be a bit relaxed and ask these things because they're really important for what I'm going to say, right? So the way you need to think about it is you take the H2 and you stretch it to say something like 10 angstroms, right?
Yeah.
But you're in a universe where they both are still there and they both know about each other. So the ground, this is terribly important, right? So the ground state is always a singlet. You can prove that for a two electron system. But it dissociates the energy of the combined system is equal to twice that of a hydrogen atom. But it has half a spin up electron and half a spin down electron on each site. So the Heitler-London wave function has, what happens is if you do a restricted calculation, like let's do Hartree-Fock as the example, then you have the doubly occupied molecular orbital. As you pull the thing apart, what you get is you get the sort of AB and BA contributions, but you also get these ionic contributions. So what's happening is that this is going to a wrong limit. It's going to a limit in which you have a 50-50 mixture of two hydrogens plus, 50% of that and 50% of an H minus with a bare proton. And that is actually this energy difference here. So all all single Slater determinant methods have this problem. They do not dissociate molecules correctly. Almost no molecules come out correct if you pull the curve apart. You can think, well, you know, we don't actually look at H2 at 10 angstroms or whatever. But in fact, this feature is sort of, they're not able to treat separated atoms. But they never tell you that in the books, right, or in the advertisements, because what you do is you calculate down here at equilibrium and you subtract off the energy of the isolated atoms. You never actually pull the thing apart.
It's restricted Hartree-Fock.
Restricted Hartree-Fock. If you do unrestricted, you will get the correct, well, you will get the energy will be correct in the dissociation limit, but you won't be in a spin eigenstate anymore, so you have a whole other bunch of issues, right? But the main thing is that we cannot, let make a chain of these guys, right? And what you're saying is that you can't see a Mach insulator, basically. It's a very.
And so I think the answer I was looking for was restricted and unrestricted Hartree-Fock.
Yeah.
Now I see the point.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, so we all kind of good. Okay. Because I can't tell everybody's language, right? Okay, so. So this is one of the key issues that you cannot look at a limit, an atomistic limit, and remember we were talking about this, Sergey, when you were visiting our workshop, right? And this question of what happens as you go toward the atomistic limit. And of course, as you go toward the atomistic limit, then things become localized on the atoms, and you have to take care of those local effects as well as the effects due to, let's say, the bonds. And this is where you run it right slap bang into this crossover region between strongly correlated and weakly correlated systems. And actually, real molecules have a very small but noticeable amount of what we call static correlation. And that is, in fact, why the hybrid functionals work, because they account for this static correlation. Just a tiny bit of this effect is important. Okay, so that's all background. Doing pretty good. So now partition theory. This is the name we've given to this thing. And there's tons and tons of stuff in the literature about this kind of stuff. But what I'll claim is that this is the sort of first time it's been kind of formally written down correctly, and this is the first paper. It was about chemical reactivity theory that Morrow and Adam wrote together. So I'm not really actually very good at doing electronic structure calculations. I almost never do. But here's one. This is a very simple model of a single atom where we just use an Eckhart potential, a 1 over Cauch squared, and then we put one particle in there in one dimension, and this is going to be our atom. We can make a simple model of a molecule by putting two of those potentials together. And I'm not even going to have interaction between my particles because it's not going to be necessary to the point I want to make. So just two particles doubly occupy the orbital, and this is the density. Okay. Now let me explain what this partition theory is. So that's what I'll use for my examples. So what came out of Morrow's thinking was this very simple procedure. So we take any system, a molecule or a solid, and it has a potential. The one-body potential is made up of the sum of nuclear potentials, right? So we won't worry about electric fields, applied electric fields for a moment. So it's made up of the sum of nuclear potentials. And here I'm going to talk, you can sort of do this more generally, but I'm going to talk about specifically partitioning the system up into individual atoms. So if the potential is the sum of nuclear terms, we're going to separate individual atoms. So this sum over alpha will be just a sum over the different nuclei in our system. And he said, so consider the atoms as isolated and minimize the sum of their energies, but requiring the sum of their densities to equal the true molecular density, or in our case, the true solid density. This is a very sort of simple procedure to imagine mathematically, but it leads to all sorts of interesting ideas. So this is just a prescription. And I call this the total fragment energy. So this is the sum of the energies of the fragments, where we go around, we minimize each fragment as if it were alone in space, but with the restriction that the sum of the fragments must equal to the true density. So these V alphas are for each of the atoms. And how do you find the minimum? Well, you just say, well, we'll put in a Lagrange multiplier that will ensure that we get the right minimum. And this Lagrange multiplier is called, we call it the partition potential. Because you have the restriction on the sum of the densities equal to the true density, then it's a potential. And it's a global property of the molecule or the solid. So I have some pictures here to see what it looks like. So here in our little toy molecule, right? So you have some given bond distance between the atoms, and at that distance you put in this partition potential, in which, what does it do? It polarizes the density towards the bond region, right? So, and in this case, it's symmetric, so left and right are the same. And so this little blue line here is this partition potential. You add it to a nuclear potential, and then solve the problem. You can prove that if you get the ground state of the problem by adding this partition potential, then it will give you this partition density, and the sum of these two densities gives you the molecular density. Let's see that happen. Woo! Okay. So what it does is it divides up the system into two pieces, each of which is, you know, the molecule, the densities are not the ground state densities of the individual atoms, but the sum of the two densities gives you the molecular density. And they're chosen by this definition, which is that the you minimize the sum of these fragment energies. So this is, you know, what I'm telling you right now is just a mathematical prescription, right? Something moral made up.
Just to make sure that I understand, the density N alpha is defined by first taking your total potential, which in this case has two peaks.
Yes.
And partitioning the total potential into two parts.
Yes.
In some way you like. Then I solve a problem with only one of the two parts, that gives me one N alpha. I solve a problem with another of the parts, that gives me a second N alpha, and then I put in this partition potential thing and combine them?
No. Almost, right? So I haven't explained it particularly well.
I guess the essential question is, how is the object N alpha of R, which appeared in your previous transparency, really defined?
They're unique, and they're defined by this requirement. So you're going to minimize the energies of all your fragments, the sum of all the energies of the fragments, subject to this constraint. So now there are many different ways you can think about this sort of logically, but the sort of simplest way is, you imagine you solve the problem first, right? You have the molecular density, and then you find those fragment densities that minimize the sum of the fragment energies.
But you're supposed to know the exact density, right?
Well, you'll see that you don't have to, because you can calculate it, as it were, on the fly. We'll get to that as we go along. But this is the formal definition, right? So the sum of these separate densities is equal to the molecular density, and then their fragment energies just directly minimizing are least. So they are not the ground state densities of their fragment potentials, but you can prove that they are the ground state densities of the fragment potential plus the partition potential. So for any system, there's one potential.
Do I understand it correctly? Do you have one functional f which is equal for all these fragments?
Okay, so I can see there's a slide missing here, right? So F is basically the Holmberg-Cohn functional, right?
Well, it's a functional of the total density. You don't have NF separate functionals for NF separate, for N separate exit alphas.
No, this is a sum over alpha, right?
A sum over alpha. So
yes.
That's how you have one universal functional and then different
alphas are in there. That's how I read it.
Yeah, that's what you do.
Yes, that's right. No, that's right. That's what it says.
To make sure I understand, what you really do in practice is you take an isolated atom, add a potential to it, and request this potential to be equal to the resulting solution to yield the density such that the sum of the two densities for your two atoms equal the molecular density. That's what you're doing.
Well, but with this constraint, because you can imagine, yes, but I mean, so that potential is unique, the one that minimizes the sum of these fragmented energies.
I think the whole thing comes in your potentials here. So, I mean, this defines these potentials, right? I mean, so.
Yes, these potentials are given, right? These are your nuclear potentials, right? So I need, yeah.
Then I don't think there's any proof that such a thing exists. I mean,
There isn't a proof that it exists. There's a proof that it's unique. And in practice, there's no reason to doubt that it would exist for typical systems,
because there's long-range forces. I mean, you're implying that everything can be reduced to a short range.
No, it doesn't imply that at all.
Okay, well.
And we'll see that. I'll show you examples of that. We find long-range effects. Yes, so you're right in that sense. So let me go through it again, right? But I can, Gabby, can you turn on the lights maybe?
Yes.
I think we need that, right? So here's A and B, right? Here's my two nuclei, right? So V alpha, for this guy, V alpha is minus 1 over R, right? So this is V1 equals that guy, V2 equals that guy, okay? Now what I'm saying is I'm going to solve each of these in a world all by themselves, and I will try to minimize their energies, but I will impose this constraint that the sum of their two densities must equal to the actual molecular density, right? So these are, let's say these are, you know, whatever, 1 angstrom apart, and their actual density looks like this, right? So I have this constraint that I want to minimize their energies as if they were alone all by themselves, but subject to the constraint that they add up to this thing. So I'm not going to find their minimum, right? If I didn't have the constraint, I would just find the isolated atom.
And imagine we do this for H2, right?
Yeah.
How many electrons do you have?
I have two electrons.
And how many do you have in your isolated atom?
Well, in this case, because of symmetry, I'll end up with one on each.
You're solving a standard hydrogen atom in an external potential.
Well, no, I'll be minimizing the energy of a hydrogen atom subject to the constraint that the sum of the two densities equals this density. That's my initial definition. What this implies then is that there's this partition potential which will look like this. This is Vp in this case. Well, let's make it Vp of x in one dimension. And if you can show that if you add this to the original one-body potential, the ground state of this in this potential plus this one gives you the fragment density, which is, you know, pushed toward the bond.
But I guess the thing which may be a little confusing is F here.
So F,
the energy function of a single hydrogen atom. Is that right?
No, F is the universal.
But it's evaluated in this particular case for a density of one electron, so it is the function for a single hydrogen atom in some kind of funny, the universal part of the function for a single hydrogen atom.
So in which case, it's just going to be the kinetic energy, in fact, in this case, because there will be no electron-electron repulsion.
Right.
But this is very special to this case.
But that's the problem I have. So if you solve this hydrogen atom, you know, A, so you do it just in a potential VA.
Yes, yes.
So VA depends on R, okay.
I should have called them A and B, right?
Okay.
But I have this constraint here, right?
Wait, I guess it depends what the R is here. I mean, are these R's for?
These are just real space.
Oh, through the whole system, including atom B.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, but VA has only its potential, right? So
part I don't see. I mean, it must know the distance to B, right?
Well, it does through this constraint. This is the total molecular density. This is the only way it knows where B is.
Be satisfied with the potential that it knows about the B.
So So V, so this is V each. So this is a sum of independent problems, right? Independent energies except for this constraint.
It becomes clear later.
Right, but at this stage, at the total N of R is an input to this process.
At this stage, yes. That will change, right? That's, and if that remained the case, I wouldn't be here today. Because it was that step that made it.
We wouldn't be talking about this.
Yeah, we'd talk about something else, right? Well, maybe I'd come, but not for this one, right? We'd be talking about semi-classics, right? Okay. So I don't do the best job in explaining this, but you'll see. As we go along, different pennies will drop, I hope. Okay. Now, this is not so. Well, this may help, I don't know, right? If you look at what Cohn and Sham did with the electronic structure problem, they replaced it with an effective non-interacting problem, which turned out to be very good for business, right? Because it's way cheaper to solve. So what do? You can think of the Cohn-Sham system as Cohn-Sham energy, like this. This isn't the real energy because that's just the energy of the Cohn-Sham electrons. Here's the real energy. And you define the Hartree and exchange correlation pieces as the difference between those two. And then the potential, which makes your non-interacting system recover the density of the interacting system, is the functional derivative of that guy. They prove that. And that's what makes the whole thing exact and useful. Okay, so what they do is, though, they do this thing. If they replace a many-body problem with a non-interacting one. This is replacing a many-atom problem with a non-interacting, of atoms that interact with a non-interacting atomic problem, right? Because you're going to solve it by solving for isolated atoms sitting in a universe all by themselves, but they have this extra potential which makes them reproduce the exact results of the true system. Now, in principle, exactly, right? And, you know, when you define all this Cohn-Sham stuff, right, you define it in terms of the exact density of the system, but later, right, you're going to make some approximation and do it self-consistently, right? Didn't see you there, Gabby. Okay, so then fragment calculation. So can you do a calculation on a set of isolated fragments? Can you get this part on a fly and can you recover the exact molecular density? And that's what Peter did, mostly against my wishes. He just went ahead and tried to do it and figured out how to do it. So one other thing I want to mention about the partitioning that may or may not be important to you is, so you then define this partition energy, right? I guess I forgot to go through it here. This is the sum of the fragments. So we define this partition energy as the difference between the real energy and the fragment energy, and then you can show that this is the potential. It comes from just differentiating the partition energy. And this partition energy is particularly handy because it's actually much, much smaller than the total energy of the system, because it's really only a difference between fragments and the real thing. And so one point I like to make is that if anybody ever running electronic structure code for a big complicated system, you know, you have to keep track of gazillion digits, right? Because you're going to take the total energy of the whole thing and then subtract off the isolated atoms or whatever it is your thing, and the difference is tiny. This you can define directly, right? This is a very small difference. And it turns out most of that is actually the dissociation energy. You can write it as a sum of two pieces, the actual dissociation energy and a kind of relaxation energy, which accounts for the change in the isolated atoms when you turn on the partition potential. And so it's much, even that's much smaller. So you're almost directly calculating the dissociation energy. And so the important thing is that if you know this or have an approximation to it, you can perform a self-consistent calculation. You guess the fragment densities, you calculate the partition potential via whatever expression you have for this thing, and then that gives you new fragment densities, and you can go and do the calculation, the self-consistency. And when you when you apply that to Cohn-Sham DFT, the important thing that you want to get out is the effective Cohn-Sham potential for a fragment. And so you can do the math and you have to be kind of careful about it, but this is what comes out. The important thing is that the quantities in here are all standard quantities in Cohn-Sham, present-day Cohn-Sham calculations. So this is a formally exact result, and it tells you exactly how you should modify the Cohn-Sham potential of an isolated atom to produce this partition effect, which will cause its density to polarize along the different directions in the of the bonds and produce this fragment, and some of the fragments will give you the total. There is a kicker, which is this guy here, but it's not too bad. This is the functional derivative of the Cohn-Sham kinetic energy, which is not something that you calculate every day in your Cohn-Sham calculation. What it says is you've got it, and it's evaluated for the entire density. So if you want to calculate this thing exactly, we have algorithms for doing that, but they're actually more expensive than solving the damn Cohn-Sham calculation in the first place. But, you know, the point of it at the moment is the principle. You know, we wanted to test, you know, we've done all our formal derivations. Do they actually work? Is it when you actually do a calculation? So we actually calculate this directly. So I'm not suggesting that as a method for calculation. I'm using it as a way to demonstrate the principle. Okay, because that's an expensive bit. It's the non-interacting. It's the non-interacting kinetic energy. So for you guys, that's not such a right. Right. But you know, if you're doing an intense calculation, so there's half a dozen algorithms around in the literature for actually doing that. But they will cost. You know, I mean, one of the applications is to actually run Cohn-Sham calculations much, much faster than they currently are, and so then people get upset about that bit. And for two particles, which we first started doing, it's easy because then it's just a von Weizsäcker. I'm going to watch the time a little bit. Okay, so, and here was one of the first calculations for this little sort of H2, right? We just added two isolated atoms, and then we set the thing going, and after about three or four iterations, it ends up giving you exactly the solution of the pair of atoms, which it ought to, right? But even that wasn't enough. Now, an important feature, as was brought up already, is what happens. So the typical case is not H2. The typical case is, you know, some bond somewhere, right, whatever it is, and you get fractions of electrons. These fragments will usually, if there isn't high symmetry, they will have fractions of electrons, and this is really important. This is what really makes the whole thing go. We know how to deal using ensembles with fractional particle number on isolated systems. We've known it for 20 years or so, and it's related to all these derivative discontinuities and gaps and stuff like that. But the main thing is that, you know, you do a calculation with a fractional number of electrons. It's simply a linear combination of the thing with, you know, Let's say you want to put 1.5 electrons on something. You do a calculation with one and a calculation with two, and you take the exact linear combination, and that is the right result if you take an ensemble and do it at finite temperature and take the temperature to zero. And the same thing is true for the energy functional itself. You just take this linear combination. So to actually do the fractional particles is not hard. It's you know, you have to do two calculations instead of one, but this is and you can prove that these are the exact expressions needed in order to do this. But this makes it very different from all of the previous suggestions in the literature, because this scheme. So when I said I'm going to minimize this fragment energy, such that the sum of the electron densities equal, right? When I do that minimization with these formulas, I will get a typically non-integer particle number. And I think if you don't have those non-integer particle numbers, lots of things go wrong, basically. And that's been missing in all the previous schemes. Oh, here we are.
Right? Whether that was true.
Hmm?
Say it's exact. This.
Yes.
So,
yes.
That?
Yes, I mean, it's exact.
Okay, so if you just take a finite system and you do an exact calculation as a function of chemical potential, you know, you have it in a bath.
And mm-hmm.
So you're saying the energy will always be a straight line relative to the number of electrons, average number of electrons on the...
So a way to think about that is, you have to think about it rather carefully, right? So you have your bath and you have a system that's, far from the bath, so energetically the bath doesn't affect it, but electrons can transfer, right? So just think of it as an infinite bath, and then, if you look at the true electronic states, right, they're actually a little bit on this guy and mostly on that, and then...
Don't worry about that. Yeah, we're just going to look at the system at certain chemical potentials as we vary.
Yes, I think this is this picture. There we go, right? So now you can, right? So as you vary the chemical potential here, right, that's exactly what happens, yes. You have to take the limits very carefully, right? But this is now absolutely, standard, let's say. So people do this.
Let me ask you a question.
It's bizarre, though.
How does it make, why can you be sure that this is really the exact functional you're saying? I can get the fractional density also to by using n electrons and n plus 2 and n plus 4. I can all kinds of variation of combination. Why I only have two neighboring combinations?
Because the exact energy, right?
Assuming that these levels here are fixed with regard to their occupation. I mean,
looks like this. As a function of particle number. So let's say
this is only true for a finite system.
Yes.
And when you go to the thermodynamic limit, that ceases to be true. Because we're all thinking constantly in the thermodynamic limit somehow in this community.
Yes,
that's
yes.
That's why this statement looks bizarre.
Yes. Yeah. No. I know you guys have trouble with this.
You guys have trouble with thermodynamics.
That's also true, right?
But let's go. But the statement at the moment is really for a finite system with a discrete set of energy levels. And if you want to take the energy level spacing to zero, you have to do it last after all the rest of this stuff. Is that the statement underlying this?
Sorry, which energy level spacing?
N and N plus 1 here. You have two energies, separation in energy, for example.
Yeah, these are all finite, right?
Exactly.
Yes.
So if we
they stay finite.
So this is all finite. That's
yes.
What I meant about
yes.
This stuff, right?
Yes. So this is all
there's
finite.
There's still the question of what does this mean in a thermodynamic limit.
Well, I can give you a little bit from us slow guys, right, who aren't so good at our thermodynamic limit. One of the strange things that Wai Tao Yang figured out in the last year or so was... as you go toward the thermodynamic limit, right, then of course all these things, the n, sort of get closer and closer together. And it turns out that, if you do an LDA calculation for the interacting energy, you have this problem here. Let me just draw it. It tends to go like this. It does very well at the integers, but it's a smooth line. It always gives you a smooth line. But if you go toward the thermodynamic limit, what happens is what you're looking at is just a tiny fraction of that smooth line. So it seems like the LDA has straight line segments because you can't see that they're actually curved. That's what happens as you go toward that limit. But those straight lines are the derivatives around this point which are wrong. And that's actually the source of the difference between the Kohn-Cham gap. The errors that the LDA makes in missing this derivative discontinuity. So everything is for finite systems. You got to do the limits the right way around. So we can, I'm around for today. We can argue about this till the cows come home, right? And there are different ways you can look at this problem and so forth. But this is the way, basically it's the correct way for finite systems. If you pull them, instead of thinking of isolated systems, I can think of them as just pulling them very far apart along the bond directions, and then you'll get exactly this formula when they stop interacting with each other. Okay, well let's get to the punchline, okay. Okay, this was for the things with slight blue are Peter's slides. That I guess the some of the notation has evolved. Anyway, this is the road to partition, right? But okay, so if you don't do this, right? If you don't do it exactly the way I said, you won't get that the sum of the isolated fragments will give you the molecular density. Okay, and here's an example of, you know, fractional occupations, 0.7, 1.3, still worked fine. But in all these cases which we had done, these little models, they were all just two particle systems. And then it's a little bit like cheating because you know the kinetic energy as a function of the density for non-interacting two particle systems. And again, he did it self-consistently and it converged. Okay. The interesting one is when he added to this one of these algorithms, and he picked a very useful one because it's very, very simple, that some guys, atomic physics friends of mine, had been doing to get Cohn-Chan potentials for atoms. Anyway, so you have to do a couple of loops, but you, so for each iteration, you then have to find the Cohn-Chan potential for the molecular density. That's a little expensive, but this is what came out. So we took a 12-atom chain, and so it was just a chain of Eckhart potentials. So we put in 12 non-interacting particles, one dimension, so it just doubly occupies the six lowest orbitals. This is the, it's trivial. This black line is the exact density of the system, and these red lines give you the converged fragment densities. So, but the point is that when he did this calculation by doing, well, because of symmetry, six or maybe three isolated atomic calculations. He never looked at this. He didn't have to look at this except for this getting of the functional derivative of the Cohn-Chan potential. And here is an example of, here's the exact partition potential, is the black line. These bumps down appear in between the atoms. And so there's this question of the long-range forces. If I take two atoms, if I take my H2 and I pull them apart, I will always have a little partition potential sitting right bang in between them. Because no matter how far I take the hydrogen atoms apart, there's always some little region where the densities overlap. And so they will be polarized a tiny bit toward each other, and so this partition potential always produces it. So it doesn't go away in the limit as the separation goes to infinity. Anyway, so this is this partition potential, and it makes it come out. And it, as you iterate, it took an awful lot of iterations because, of course, and here's our fractional particle numbers. Of course, the this long chain is really a metal. And so it does slosh around an awful lot, and you see the typical sort of oscillations that you get when you do a finite slab of a metal. But that doesn't matter for today's purposes. And when you look at the numbers are exactly as I said. Total energies are very large, but then this partition dissociation energy is much smaller, and then the difference between that and the partition energy is also much smaller. So this partition energy captures, directly the dissociation of the thing. Okay, so the implications, right? This is the fun part, right? So one of the very important things is if you set the exchange correlation contribution to the partition energy to zero, it automatically gets the right atomic limits, which density functional calculations never do. And now you could say, well, it's a bit of a violation. You started off with some functional approximation, LDAs, GGAs, whatever, and then you turned off a bit of them, and that's true. But in this world of fragment densities, there's no violation at all. So you get both H2 plus and H2 to behave correctly. You don't get any, it will dissociate into half an electron on one hydrogen, half on the other in the H2 plus. Or the correct hydrogen atoms here. So it's a way around.
This little partition potential which remains?
It's not so much we have the partition potential that remains, it's that you're calculating the total energy as a sum of fragment energies plus a correction. And the fragments do dissociate to the right limits. So as long as your correction doesn't start messing with that, which it will in a normal DFT calculation, this partition, those bits of the energy will cause it to go wrong, because it always reproduces the exact one, the correct one for that functional. So it avoids that. So it gets both self-interaction and strong correlation automatically correct. Of course, I mean, we try that, right? Because, hey, that would be really, really something, right? But it's lousy back at equilibrium, right? Because there's no sort of free lunch, right? If you turn those pieces off in this partition, then you screw up your functional for normal everyday uses, right? So it will dissociate things correctly, but it's no longer accurate at equilibrium. Because you threw out a chunk of. But what that does is basically, if you think about the H2 plus type thing, I mean, you can just turn off the right pieces and it looks exactly the same as a self-interaction correction, right? If you turn off exactly the right pieces.
But if you go to complete
at separated ends, right?
That comes with, say, D electrons, where the, the state is, the ground state is some.
I've only done little 1D cases, right? I haven't yet moved from, as my chemistry friends say, moved from 1D to 3D. That's a terrible joke. Okay, so all I can say, there's all sorts of things to be added, right? You've got to start, doing spin decompositions. You've got to start looking at multiplet structures and all those things, right? But the basic mathematical scheme is that you can get something where you can treat all those things correctly at the atomic level and then talk about how those atoms will interact with each other. So it's a formal scheme, right? It's not... There are a million different approximations you can start making by turning on and off bits of this, right? And which ones make sense and so forth will remain to be seen. So I'm not going to sort of claim too much, right? And the Hartree partition energy contains these long-range polarizing Coulomb effects, right? So again, you can, there's all sorts of uses for this. I'll go through them in a minute. And notice also that it's sort of one of the problems, right, that with, the DMFT or whatever, you can always sort of ask, well, sort of why do you choose the atomic-centered basis sets and things or whatever, the way that you do the calculation, but why are the lattice sites where they are? Shouldn't everything be basis set independent? And you say, well, if we have a fully... big enough cluster and everything will converge, right? But sort of in the meantime, right? Whereas this sort of sidesteps that, because it says you can set up your whole scheme with, the positions of the nuclei are kind of determined by your Hamiltonian, and that's what determines what the atomic limit is. I don't know if this makes any sense to anybody here. Whenever you have a lattice model, right, you have this question of, well, sort of where did it come from, right? Why do you have it in the basis set that you do? You've approximated the Hamiltonian in some particular basis set, right? Usually localized atomic orbitals, right?
But I guess the point of confusion, at least, that I have is, on the one hand, you said choosing the atomic positions. That's the general debate. That's fine. The question is choosing the particular subset of all the orbitals associated with that atom that you want to focus on. So I didn't quite get that connection. How does this tell me which subset of all of the many, many orbitals that are centered on a copper atom in a high TC superconductor that I want to focus on? How do I pick out just one or two orbitals using this procedure? Not one or two things associated with a position, but one or two orbitals.
So it doesn't do that in a sense at all, right? It's almost the reverse of that, right? Because the things that you're used to seeing in terms of orbital, well, in terms of these localization and delocalization type effects, right, are gone when you do the fragment calculation, right? In exactly the same way, that the electron-electron interaction is gone when you do a Cohn-Cham DFT calculation, right? It's just gone. On the other hand, it ain't gone, right? It's in the pieces. So I haven't told you how to do that yet. But what I'm saying is that there's a framework in which you can really address these questions that are completely, you know, independent of basis set effects and things like that.
It's not gone, right? It's encoded in VP of R.
Yes, exactly.
Find the atomic limit, VP of R will be atom-centered. If you are close to the molecular limit, VP of R will have a polarization, essentially. Will polarize the electron to the other.
It always...
shape will be more asymmetric.
No, it'll always be symmetric. Actually, it doesn't even change size a whole lot, even as you bring the two things together. These densities, I mean, a very important feature of this is that the densities, when you give them integer occupations, so whatever, if it comes out to be 0.75, you multiply it by 1 over 0.75, the densities don't change a whole lot. And actually, this is one of the original motivations.
Potential, not the density.
Yeah, and the potential doesn't change a whole lot, in fact, because its effect on the atoms changes as you bring the atoms together, right? So if I just put this potential here, so its distance from your center is always going to be half the molecular distance. So if I have the two things very far apart, I have this potential far from my nucleus, and it has almost no effect. It just polarizes a little bit. As I bring them in, it just stays there, but it has a bigger effect on my density.
It's very similar to the hybridization function in the MFT. It's a very similar construct.
Well, that's right. That's why I'm here, right? Exactly. I can't give this talk in DMFT language, right? But if we sat down, it may not be so hard.
And the potential, is it unique?
Because yes.
What would happen if you were saying now you allow different occupation on the different atoms? If you were going and starting from something which has the nuclear potential for the other atom,
yes,
in the VP of R. So the only thing that would be different is that you have the combined density.
Yes, so actually we set up the formalism where you can actually pick a partitioning scheme. So you say which atoms are in your partition, and once you say that, it's unique for that choice.
Otherwise, you could do this, right? You could just, it would be a very large VP, so it's probably not what...
Oh, okay, yes, so... So we only ever looked at those choices in the sense that I would claim on grounds of the fact that we're actually studying nature that those are the relevant choices. From a physics point of view, you can choose whatever you like.
You would have an infinite, suppose there are probably an infinite set of different VP of R's that you could have. They would be far away, but let's say in your optimization, you might fall into one of those.
Okay, yeah, there's two issues getting mixed up, but that's a very important one. The question is of localization, right? And this is one that we haven't been able to, we've tried and haven't been able to satisfy ourselves, but on the other hand, it's looking much less serious. So, which is, we haven't done any calculations for an extended system. We're not so good at the thermodynamic limit. And so the question would be, say I take silicon and I make the atoms my fragments, then I'll get a bunch of my partition potential will be all over the whole crystal. It'll be little bumps in between the bonds, right? In between the atoms where the bonds are, will be little bumps everywhere. And then I solve my problem, right, by putting in a real atom in this checkerboard and solve just for the things there, and I get a silicon with, you know, four bits pointing in the different directions, in the bond directions. But the question is, if that partition potential gets so big that the electron, you know, the electrons that are supposed to be localized there spread out over the whole lattice, then I'm toast, right? Because then it's no good. It's just a bit of formalism. As far as we can see, it really looks like there's no reason to think that that will happen, but we can't prove that, and we don't have an example yet.
That's actually a good example. If you take the silicon, so would it go into, would it break the symmetry of the crystal? Would it go into one bond, and then basically each silicon would just have the VP into one bond direction, or would you have four? So would they always share the bonds?
Presumably, although until we do it, you can't be sure, but what I would expect is that you get a little bump down everywhere where there's a bond. Okay. So you're going to have your silicon atom, and you're going to have the tetragonal structure, so you will have little VPs pulling it a little bit in each direction. So this is connected to lots and lots of things that we know, but the point is that it starts from that Lagrangian, right? It's not something that sort of, where you chose your favorite basis set in a sense because it physically tells you what's going on in the problem, right? So for Andy's question, how do you handle it? So we haven't done any of that, but what I'm saying is it gives you a way to think about these connections, right? Where people won't beat up on you for not being first principles or whatever, the usual little spats that we have, right? Well, you guys don't have those spats. But you guys... some are worse than others, right? Other things, right? One thing that the other half, the people who are in the fall, get real excited about is if you can make some sort of neighborhood type approximation for this guy. I mean, you can just do your Cohn-Sham calculation by doing isolated fragments. It's really, if you think about that chain, he just did calculations on isolated atoms, and you get the results for. Now, so we tried to do this in that calculation and failed, but that was probably because we were looking at a chunk of metal, right? Not smart. But he had, I only noticed that after he'd sort of done the calculation. And it's unlikely that you can do that kind of thing. But if it's really an insulator, a band insulator, then I would think that this thing will converge rapidly. So instead of doing this inversion process over the entire molecule, you just do it in a region where you are. But as soon as you do something like that, then you can calculate an enormous system by just doing a sum of fragment things. The only thing that could go wrong is if convergence gets real slow, right? If the fragments start and keep talking to each other, and so they don't settle down. But this is a growth industry, let's say. Conferences and all sorts of things, people trying to do that kind of stuff. QMMM is another huge thing that lots and lots of regular theoretical chemists, computational chemists, are doing all the time, making up all sorts of methods for chopping up systems, right? And this is what I'm saying, where the fractional particle number really comes in. When we do this formal machinery, what do we see? We see that you end up with some fraction of electrons in here and some fraction there. If you look at all the schemes that people suggest, what they do is they remove all this and put a hydrogen atom or something. I mean, and now people are beginning to build pseudo-potentials which will sort of move electrons across the divide. They want to treat some part of the system with molecular mechanics and the other part quantum mechanically. But a key thing is get that fractional particle number. So again, it should be a way of doing it. And then, of course, there's philosophy, right? Chemists for 100 years or whatever have tried to figure out where the atoms are in the molecules, because this is a big, big question in chemistry, because you know that chemical groups exist. You know that organic chemists make a damn good living, right? Because they can understand the properties of chemical groups. But if you do an electronic structure calculation, all your electrons delocalize and their orbitals all over the place. So where are the atoms in the molecules? And this was the question that actually Morrill was originally addressing. Can you construct a theory that has these atoms in the molecules, then do perturbation theory on top of that to show? So this has gone on in literature for forever. And then things like charges and things like that. And also, this is a very weird alternative to all those Wannier functions, right? They're almost anti-Wannier functions because they get rid of all the delocalization of the electrons. Okay. So molecule or solid into fragments, but we haven't done a solid yet. You can easily write it down. Oh, so one thing I forgot to emphasize is, of course, you can go through this formal machinery, and I set it up. It's really simple in Cohn-Cham DFT because of the emphasis on the density. But you could treat any fragment by any more sophisticated method, right? That you like. So that's an easy way to combine methods. But you know, I think more important is this idea where you can think about all sorts of things that people do and write them all in the same language, right? So this is my question for you guys, right? How does DMFT look in this scheme? Can you use it to sort of, can you say, oh, if I just turn this little bit off, voila, that looks like a DMFT calculation, right?
Well, DMFT deals with the impurity, right?
Yeah, so it's like it's set up as an impurity formalism, right? So if we could sit down and write that out, I think that would be important, right? But I got to go back tonight. So we've got to work fast, guys.
What would happen if, let's say now you have atomic problems, and then you could say, okay, if they're simple enough, let's do a CI. Let's then get for what I'm looking at the values of the exact function.
Yes, exactly.
So what would the algorithm then give? Because you have exact input now on the atomic level, somehow you have to feedback something of the extended system. So where is still now the problem hidden that you wouldn't get?
Okay, so I have put all those problems are now in this partition energy functional in exactly the same way as all the problems are in the exchange correlation energy in DFT, right? So there's no free lunch, right? You've translated them all into that. But now we have this object that you can look at and think about, and it's formally exactly defined, and you can ask, what pieces do I have to put in there in order to make it work physically, let's say, right? What are good approximations to that thing that but that automatically get the atomic limit right, and therefore, can you do a perturbation theory, for example? Like I say, I set it all up in Cohn-Cham DFT with these Cohn-Cham potentials and so forth. And you could, so actually last night I was trying to go backwards and say, well, you could imagine, I mean, there's just so many ways that you can think of going that it actually just becomes a problem of you've got to run things and see, right? But one thing you could do is imagine doing a straight DFT calculation on something of interest, but the DFT is not so good, right? I don't know. And then this tells you these Cohn-Cham potentials for the atoms, right? And actually you could work backwards and figure out a one-body potential, the real one-body potential for the fragment, at least the approximation to it implied by DFT, and then do a much more sophisticated treatment on your fragment. You can do that. Whether or not this would turn out to be accurate enough, who knows, right? I mean, you can do it so many different ways by playing with these bits that it starts getting really, you've got to sit down, somebody's got to sort of, pick a system, do a little coding and see how things work. But first, even before that, is can you write down DMFT in this language, right? Because then you can, you look at those guys and you say, oh, that's what we're doing to the DFT guy. That's what, I've seen you, right? You've been running these electronic structure calculations, right? And trying to get this crossover, right?
But the scheme is still set up to reproduce the density of the system, right?
That's its definition, right? In exactly the same way as the Cohn-Cham definition is.
But I didn't fully understand how do you work when you don't know the density of the system, so when you don't have the exact solution.
Right. So what I set up here, right, was this very simple 12-atom chain, and they're non-interacting. And in that case, I could figure out what all these formal pieces were. And in particular, I could figure out we have these algorithms which give us these potentials. So what happens is I guess a density, and I have this self-consistent procedure where, so I guess fragment densities. So let's say I start with isolated atoms, which we always do. We get the overlapped density, putting them in their right places. And then we have, in this case, we can exactly find this contribution to the partition potential, which kind of pushes it toward being the exact answer.
But how do you change the density? Because this partition potential really ensures that you get a target density. And now, in your iteration, you change
the density. So by figuring out those formulas, right, how it functionally depends on both the fragment densities and the total density, so we make a guess, we have fragment densities, total density, we feed it in, and it produces a partition potential, but those are not the right densities, right? They're not the final answers. You started with them, right?
Maybe could you show the slide again?
This was it, sort of bouncing around with the occupation numbers, just showing how they level out after a while. I guess there's six.
What is the algorithm?
The algorithm. Okay, so it's just, this is the stupidest algorithm you can do, but it works, and so it's the least amount of coding. And what it does is, so there's two loops, right? So we start with the isolated atoms, we get those densities, we overlap them, and that gives us a trial molecular density and a trial set of fragment densities. Now the hard part is to calculate this thing here, this Cohn-Chan potential, for your trial molecular density. And this iteration here is designed to do that. When you iterate this thing, so this would be, let's say your target this is your target density here, and this is a guess. So this is a guessed Cohn-Chan potential. So all you do is, in fact, you have your target density, which is just the sum of the fragment densities overlapped, and then what you want to do is find the Cohn-Chan potential for which that is the ground state density. That's what this thing does.
You have a density, that's you fix it, it's your starting density, you solve the problem, and okay. Then how do you proceed
further
to find the actual density of the real system?
So I start off with a partition potential is zero, right? So then my fragments are just isolated fragment densities.
Yeah, and I give you a total density and you solve this problem.
So you give me a total density, right, which is just a sum of isolated fragments, and I can reconstruct the one body potential, which is the potential in this case, because there's no interaction, for which that's a ground state density. Mm-hmm. And that's one of my ingredients in my partition potential. So that's a very expensive step. What it does is it searches one body potentials until it finds the one that reproduces that trial density, right? But that's still a trial density.
Question, if your trial density is the sum of these
fragments,
yes, then any partition potential will be, right?
No, I mean...
No, really it should be zero, because...
It does seem logically odd, but it's because... That would be true if you had very long bond lengths. Because your trial density is the sum of overlapped guys, the fact that it's overlapped means that it's no longer isolated, right? It's a trial density for a molecule, not for isolated pieces. And because of that, that means that this thing picks up a partition potential.
What is that the functional f of n,
yes,
is not the sum of n of n alpha? Right? It's not linear.
Yeah. It's highly sort of non-linear because of the constraint that the sum of them equals the total.
Even without the constraint. So it's not true that f of n is equal to the sum of f of n alpha.
Not at all.
Not at all.
Yes, when they're bonded. If they're far apart, yes, exactly.
Other questions? Comments?